Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast from the BBC World Service, bringing you extraordinary personal stories from around the globe. Search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
The time when I came closest to giving up was having to watch two chimpanzees that I knew very well, and one of them killed the other one. That was one of the hardest days in the forest. I think if I'd had the next day off, if I'd gotten myself thinking about it too deeply, maybe I wouldn't have gone back in. My name is Dr. Kat Hobeta, and I'm a primatologist at the University of St. Andrews. I suppose the primary quest of my research is just to try and understand what it means to be a chimpanzee. What's going on in their minds? What's it like to live life as a chimp? The beautiful Budongo rainforest, which is up in northwestern Uganda, has been home for most of the last 20 years now. I've spent about 6 months of the year for most of that time living out in the forest. And I've actually, at this point in my life, probably spent longer living in rainforests than I have in any other place. Wet socks. Instant coffee. Rain on the tin roof. I love that sound, especially if you're cozy in bed. It really does feel like going home to me when I go back there. I fell completely in love with the idea of studying the evolution of minds and thinking and behaviour. I met a professor from the University of St. Andrews who sent me out to Uganda. I went out and being there in the forest, getting to be a part of their world, being in the forest with them, just helped me recognize how many things I really didn't know how to ask or didn't even know where to start. Our research camp is in the forest, and I get up in the morning and we walk sometimes an hour and a half up to where we left the chimps the night before. What we're doing is we're going into the forest in the dark before the chimpanzees are awake in order to go and meet them so that we can spend the whole day together. As you start to hike into the forest, one of the beautiful things about walking in the dark is that you hear everything. And I love that. I know that I've walked this path every day for months and months and years at this point. So I can do it in the dark and I turn my head torch off. You just sort of float out through the forest and you hear all of those sounds right through the forest as everything wakes up. One of my absolute favorite is the colobus monkeys that we have in Budongo have what we call a dawn chorus. One group will start and then the next group and then the next group. And one of the things that I love about that feeling is that we're one of the most easterly forests in Africa. But actually, you find colobus monkeys from East Africa all the way to West Africa. And so I just love the idea that this morning wave that just resonates through the forest of the colobus monkeys as they're waking up and passing on that call to the next group and the next group right across the continent, kind of like a Mexican wave being sent from one side of Africa to the other. chimpanzees can live well into their 60s. So they have a very similar, in some ways, life history to ours. And you recognize a chimpanzee exactly the same way as you'd recognize a person. So it's their features of their face, the way they move, the sound of their voices. Most of what you see of chimpanzees, because they spend a lot of time up in trees, is you see them from the underside up. So you get to recognize chimpanzee bottoms sometimes a lot better than you recognize their faces. One of the chimps that has fascinated me for a really long time is called Nambi. So chimpanzees, typically their politics and their social hierarchy is technically run by males, but females have a lot of leverage, and Nambi knew exactly how to exercise it. She is probably in her mid-60s at this point. She lives in the Sonso community in Bodongo, and she is just the head of this epic dynasty of a family. She has had sons and daughters, she's got grandchildren, and it's just been this immense, immense privilege to have been able to be a part of her life for this long. So she's in what we would call the equivalent of menopause now. But some of the most fascinating days have been her with her sons. Essentially, she's like one of those helicopter mums, socially engineering her children's lives. Her last boy, Musa, was this slightly layabout. Honestly, he has a powerful, high-ranking mother, didn't really have to work that hard, never really cut the apron strings kind of boy, who could easily have been alpha male, but he just honestly didn't seem like he could be bothered. And so what Nambi would do sometimes is she would be the one to go up and she would groom all the high-ranking boys. And, you know, this is Nambi and she's very influential. So they were very, you know, accepting of her coming over and grooming. And she would groom the alpha male and then she'd groom Musa and then she'd groom the alpha male and then she'd groom Musa. And she would just sort of move backwards and forwards between them and then slowly, slowly, slowly kind of withdraw herself. And very effectively have essentially inserted Musa into this kind of high-ranking male grooming clique. And so there are all sorts of little ways in which she would make sure that her children were in all of these positions of power. One of my absolute hardest days in the forest was when Lola, she was in estrus, that means she was ovulating, she was able to have a baby. And that's going to attract a lot of attention from the boys. And we had our ex-alpha male, Dwayne, who I knew incredibly well. And that's part of what I think made this hard is, you know, I knew these two chimps. This was not our chimps and strangers from the neighbors. Not that that's a great day in the forest, but these were two individuals I knew well. And he had been alpha male, but he wasn't anymore. He was a bit too old now. So what he really wanted to do was for her to come away with him so that they could go off and he would get exclusive access to her in that time. And so he was asking her to follow him. And Lola, who was still quite a young adult female, she would come over and that's not what he wanted. So he would chase her or threaten her. And it gets to the point where Dwayne is incredibly frustrated and he is hitting her and chasing her. Sometimes she is screaming and running away. The violence of this escalates. Because it was just me and the two of them in the forest, she would sometimes run behind me screaming and sort of, I'm there filming what is this incredibly rare behavioral interaction. I know I have to take this data, but I can remember standing there in the forest with tears running down my face, knowing that I could have intervened and knowing that I couldn't and I shouldn't, and that wasn't my place, and I was there to observe and I was there to understand. And I can close my eyes and picture it right now and still see her face. And I wasn't sure she'd basically escaped at the end of the day. But the next morning we go into the forest and we find her dead. She'd had some hemorrhaging on her brain and she just hadn't been able to stay conscious through the night. I went home that night and put my camera down and poured a very large, very stiff whiskey. It was a really pivotal moment for me because I think it told me that what it means to be a chimpanzee is not just the fun stuff. If we want to understand them, if we want to understand how their behavior relates to ours, we have to do it justice and to look at all parts of that, even when they get tough. I love when a big storm comes. I've always loved, you know, rainstorms and thunder and lightning, but there's something really special about being in the forest when that comes. It will obviously go very dark, but before that you hear the wind in the trees, and it almost sounds like it's raining, but it's not. It's just the wind getting up through the forest, and you can hear it coming towards you from the distance. It comes at you like a wall of water. Actually, one of my absolute most favorite things, and it doesn't happen very often, is if you are with the chimps and it is a big, dramatic, sky tearing apart thunder kind of sound. The chimpanzees will rain dance. Most chimp displays are big and noisy and extremely vigorous, and rain dancing, it is perfectly described as a dance because it's almost like ballet. Not everybody in the group, but you'll have one or two of the big males will start, and they'll be sort of swaying backwards and forwards, and then they might run up a tree or kind of move, but they're doing it in this just this fluid, beautiful, flowing movement. The big males will be swaying back and forth, sometimes two, three, four of them doing it in synchrony, and they're completely silent, which big males very rarely are when they're displaying. It puts the hair up on the back of your neck because you're in this big storm, but then watching them experiencing it and sort of almost feeling their awe of this genuinely awesome event. It's moments like that where you feel deeply connected, but also like there's so much that you still have to understand. I've accomplished what I thought I might be interested in doing when I first started, but the thing is, the quest just gets bigger. You know, I wanted to know how chimpanzees communicated with each other, and in particular their gestures. But then realizing, oh, well, wait a second, if I can describe what they're gesturing about to each other, to a certain extent, I know what they're kind of talking about with each other. So now I can ask things like, how do their relationships change and vary? Who's who? All those social politics. You basically get the key to the whole soap opera of their daily lives. At this point, it's been decades of my life still wondering about some of the questions that I was first thinking about the first day that I spent with chimpanzees.
Next on Obsessed with the Quest for Discovery, Sarah Dykeman describes her cycling adventure to follow the migration of monarch butterflies.
I rode my bicycle following the monarch butterfly migration from Mexico to Canada and back, which ended up being 10,201 miles. There were moments where I'd been biking all day and I hadn't seen a monarch, and I'd seen acre after acre of perfectly mowed grass, and I would see a little milkweed on the side of the road, and then I would see the mower coming to mow down that last little tiny bit of prairie, and I just wanted to lay there and cry. My name is Sarah Dykeman, and I'm part amphibian biologist, part adventurer, part educator, a writer, and, oh boy, a little bit of everything. My bicycle is what I describe as a yard sale that exploded. It's a little bit of everything. It's an old beat-up mountain bike that I bought for about $200. On the bike are panniers, which hold all my gear. The front ones were store-bought, but the back ones are made from old kitty litter buckets. It's comfortable. It gets me where I need to go, and no one wants to steal it. It's funny because whenever I describe a monarch butterfly, I describe them as orange and blue. And I realize that I always picture a monarch on a blue sky. Monarchs are like a nice deep orange with these like black veins and some white spots. They're really flappy flyers. They're not in a hurry, and they're pretty big. The beginning of my trip, my motivation was to have an adventure, to learn, and to share my passion for the environment with kids by linking my trip and the butterflies to schools. Halfway through my trip, I realized the monarchs need a voice. The monarchs need people to step up and change how we live and change how we view the world. My motivation became fighting as hard as I could for this butterfly. I arrived to Mexico in the coldest part of the winter in January. The monarchs are at about 10,000 feet above sea level. You see a little cluster, and then your eyes sort of adjust, and you start to see all the clusters, and then you realize there's millions of monarchs hanging from these trees. And then you come back a few months later when it's gotten warmer, when the migration is beginning, and you could close your eyes, and you could hear a million monarchs flapping their wings. No one expects to be able to hear a monarch butterfly. It's subtle, but you can. It's really beautiful. When I started my trip, the first few miles were sort of surreal because I was on this road and I felt like I was in a river of butterflies. And because it was like a bumpy road, I wasn't going terribly fast. So I was kind of meeting the monarchs where they were, and we were just kind of traveling together. I always describe it as like a river of orange wings. And it felt amazing. I mean, I was a little anxious at the start. And that kind of came to a head a few miles after starting when the monarchs just kind of went their northern route into the forest and I stood there on the road, which went the opposite direction, and I thought, oh my gosh, Canada is really far away. What am I doing? A lot of people told me that this trip was a bad idea, and so you're standing there watching the monarchs abandon you and recognizing how much you have ahead of you. I didn't actually see many monarchs after that for probably a couple weeks. And I just remember thinking, this is going to be so embarrassing when I do this whole trip and I don't see any monarchs. And I saw three in Mexico and I threw my bike down. I danced in the middle of the highway. Cars probably thought I was going mad. I was a little bit. And then slowly, as I hit Texas in the Midwest, I would start to see one or two a day. And then I realized, like, it didn't really matter if I saw monarchs, because every single day, every single person that I stopped and talked to, that passed me on the highway, that I met at a grocery store, that I visited at a school, that was the point. The point wasn't actually to bike with monarchs, wasn't to follow a specific monarch the whole way. The point was to be their voice. And so it was meeting the people that could protect the monarch that became the goal.
Hey,
I left Mexico in March following monarchs, and I'm 100% sure that the monarchs that I started with didn't finish the trip. And this is, to me, the most amazing part of the migration, is that it's multi-generational. I left with the monarchs that had overwintered. They made it to the southern part of the United States, Oklahoma, Texas, and they laid their eggs and then they died. And those eggs became the first generation of the season. So I followed the kids of the overwintering monarchs, and then I followed the grandkids, and then I followed the great-grandkids, and even the great-great-grandkids, all the way back to Mexico. So we're talking about an insect that grows up on some milkweed, the only food source of those monarch caterpillars, and then becomes a butterfly and flies thousands of miles to a tree that their great-great-grandmother rested on the winter before without ever having been there, without having any guides. I remember a moment, I think I was in maybe in Indiana, and I crossed a railroad track, and it's just this weedy-looking spot. But I had noticed some milkweed. I was very good at spotting milkweed, and I stopped my bike because I was also very good at coming up with any reason to take a rest, and I found a little egg. You can read about it, you can know the facts, but when you look at a little egg on a milkweed thousands and thousands of miles from Mexico and know that that egg has the potential to go that distance, to navigate with all these other butterflies to the same trees, it's just so amazing. And that was what I wanted, is I want other people to feel that amazement, to have that moment of awe. People always thought that it was the miles or even the weather or hills that would be the hardest. But 100%, those things are all so much easier to tackle than what I think the hardest part of my trip was, which was just the mental energy that went into spending every single day biking through monarch habitat, seeing what the monarchs have to face and how limited their space is now. And I was alone, and my trip was like, I think, 8.5 months, and I spent 10 hours a day looking at the destruction, and it hurt my brain, it hurt my heart and my soul, and that was 1,000 times harder than any hill I've ever biked up. People expected me, you know, butterflies are so happy, you must always be happy, and I was just so mad, and I'm tearing up just thinking about how mad I was. I just wanted anyone to feel the anger that I was feeling. And then, like, recognizing that wouldn't work, part of me just wanted to just go somewhere else, that I didn't have to face these facts. But then I would meet someone that cared, and they would remind me that I'm not the only one feeling this. So many amazing people, and we were all connected because of this butterfly. When I got to Canada, I knew I was only halfway done, but I honestly just try not to think about the big picture ever. So when I was in Canada, I wasn't thinking about Mexico, I was thinking about Ohio. And I was thinking about the presentations I was going to give. So I just really only focused on each chunk at a time. The obstacles that I think a lot of people would have thought would be my breaking points, like a mechanical breakdown or a super rainy day or the day I had to literally bail water out of my tent with my cooking pot, those actually aren't the moments that I look back at as like the hardest part. I actually am really grateful for those moments. I think they're like a fun distraction. I have this good habit of whenever something is really tough, when I am just like freezing cold and battling a terrible wind on a scary road, I just always think, oh, this will be a good story, or oh yeah, I'm not going to forget this. I spoke to about 9,000 kids on my trip. I have a memory of going out to a school garden, and when you tear milkweed, a little bit of this like gooey white latex poison will ooze out like sap, and all the kids erupted into cheers because they thought it was a little egg, but it was just a pinprick of this milky latex. I better look closer, and then they saw a real egg, and it was just like we'd won the $1 million. And then a monarch flew over our heads, and like, it was Super Bowl winning status. Like, we were all so happy to see this butterfly. The last 3 miles of the trip included the hardest hill of the entire trip. Super, super steep. And I remember giving it literally everything I had. And then I walked a little bit. And so I'm plodding along and I saw a monarch. And I just remember, like, being amazed. Just being like, oh my gosh, you actually do this. You actually fly back to Mexico. I kind of stopped and watched that monarch and was just like really grateful to them. And then you get to the colony and it's always pretty surreal to finish a trip. But I was really grateful because when I got there, all of the guides, locals that lead people up the mountains, they were all congratulating me, and I remember parking my bike and being like, I'm almost done. And then I walked a little bit up the hill and saw them, and remember thinking, like, which of you did I see on my trip? Who? This is the most emotional part for me. My favorite thing to do is to think about all the monarchs that exist in that forest in Mexico, because people cared, because people decided to share their yards, because teachers decided to give their students that chance, to give the monarchs a chance. And so I just remember thinking of all the gardens I'd seen and all the people I met and which of those monarchs, like, owed their existence to those people. And it just is such a beautiful example of, like, our choices do matter. Because those monarchs wouldn't be here without people deciding that there's more important things than having a perfect lawn. Yeah.
Lives Less Ordinary brings you remarkable personal stories from across the globe. From people who've chased their dreams.
No one knew that I was going to travel by bike. If I had told them that I was riding a bike to Egypt, they might have said that it was impossible.
To people who've lived through nightmares.
Being in jail in Thailand, I made a promise to myself in that jail that when I'm home, I'm going to volunteer somewhere.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.